Welcome to the What If podcast, conversations about the future with leading scholars, research and experts. My name's Luke Good, and today we're joined by Darl Kolb, who's Professor of Connectivity in the Graduate School of Management at the University of Auckland. Darl is a pioneering theorist of social and technical connectivity, and I recently heard him give a fascinating public talk entitled Life Among the Robots, in which he invited us to rethink the relationship between humans and smart machines as we face the prospect of a highly automated future. In particular, he suggests that humans and machines are engaged in a process of co-evolution, and also that the rise of smart robots and AI should be seen not so much as a threat, but as an opportunity for humans to figure out and focus on what makes us human and what humans are really good for. Darl, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you, Luke. Glad to be here.
So I want to begin by talking, first of all, about some of the areas of society most likely to be affected by robots and automation. And obviously, your focus is primarily on work organizations and the economy. So let's just start there. And it seems to me that the prospect of automation raises different scenarios, different potential scenarios, one of which is that we face a massive increase in unemployment, for example. A slightly different scenario is one that where we share out the benefits of automation and have a more generalized reduction in the working week and a rise of leisure time. There's another scenario by which some people say that technology is going to generate more new jobs than we're going to lose. So which of those do you think is the more plausible?
Well, I think the safest answer is that the new technologies we're talking about, artificial and machine intelligence, robotics, are probably going to create some new jobs. And I think there has, along with the optimism of co-evolution, there's been a bit more optimism about job creation. And of course, historically, we think of jobs being created by technology. So we can't deny that. But also, many jobs will be lost. And so I would say that's the safest answer. The massive unemployment scenario, I think, would be most likely to be a combination effect of other economic factors plus a technological sort of intersection, a GFC, for example, that some are also talking about coming. And that could be the combination 1-2 punch that we might see.
So we're used to thinking of, and we don't want to focus too much just on threats in this conversation, but let's just sort of pause there for a moment. We're used to thinking of particularly blue-collar jobs, manufacturing, etc., being wiped out by machines. But to what extent are white-collar and information-rich jobs, doctors, lawyers, teachers like ourselves, to what extent are those jobs at risk from automation?
Well, that seems to be the thing about automation 2.0, as it were, that the first round of automation, which has been about 100 years long at least, has been taking blue-collar and sort of manual jobs away from humans or replaced by machines. And by the way, even in those scenarios, I once visited the Volvo factory in Sweden, and they produce great products, but they have a very strong combination of robots and humans. So again, it isn't always just one or the other. But now we're talking about other professions, accounting, law, that are certainly at risk. Insurance and banking. I'm having lunch with an insurance CFO today. They're concerned about this. And I'll give you an example. One of my graduate students got a job in a local bank, Australian-owned local bank. I met up with her afterward. It was to just catch up. And I said, "How's it going?" She goes, "Oh, it's not. It's okay." She says, "I work in wealth management." That sounds very exotic, very exciting. And I said, "What does that mean?" She says, "Well, I'm basically taking information on KiwiSaver applications and putting it into a database." And so, and even she could recognize that this is something a human, it's a very boring human job. So those are examples. And certainly, I know that banking and insurance, et cetera, are trying to revisit process and bring in automation.
So aside from employment, what do you think are some of the other areas of society that are likely to be most significantly impacted on by the rise of robots and smart machines?
Well, robots and automation, or robots in general, are fun. So we probably see some increase in, I mean, things like drones, for example, I think will be widely popular. Robots are starting to get their way into kids' repertoire. And I suppose if you grow up with a robot, you'd be like growing up gaming. You probably would carry that on through life. Certainly in navigation and travel, I mean, you know, people, it actually is amazing how I've been with people who refuse to eat in a restaurant that hasn't been appropriately vetted on Yelp, instead of just walking into a restaurant. So we do bring these technologies with us, and they serve a great purpose, which is, again, separate from work. Education is another broad area, and of course, we work in that space. I don't know about job reduction in the short run, but in the long run, I think it's entirely possible for some reasons that partly because the technology is possible, but also the way that MOOCs have made it possible to sort of have a winner-take-all approach to the economics of education. So we can talk about that maybe later. Mm.
So one of the things I find really interesting about your public talk was this idea that we need to get away from a kind of scaremongering us versus them perspective on the rise of robots. And you argue that humans and machines have been and will continue to be engaged in a relationship of co-evolution, and that it's important for us to recognize that as we approach the future. Could you maybe just flesh that argument out a little bit, explain it, and perhaps give us an example of how we co-evolve with machines?
Well, I guess another way to look at it is that machines are simply tools, and they're an extension of ourselves, but that is still true. So, for example, a surgery robot, which is Da Vinci, for example, one surgeon explained to me he felt that was simply an extension of his ability to do surgery as a human. So we can see these as tools. If we see them in a co-evolutionary sense, then we have to accept that they're getting better and we're getting better alongside each other, and that is what I've been proposing. The challenge, of course, is to see to as humans is to not become stagnant or not lazy. But for example, there is a concern that with autopilot, pilots actually do lose their ability to land and take off planes as proficiently as if they did it every day in practice without the machinery. So we're at risk of getting complacent. So I think that's part of the challenge. But I do think it's possible. The other thing I think might be that a co-evolutionary symbiotic relationship might be that maybe we're thinking the wrong thing if we think that our brains are going to keep up with artificial intelligence. Maybe the robots will, or automation and machine intelligence will actually surpass us in that arena, but that they will, but the questions we ask them, of course, are our domain. And so maybe things like critical thinking and actually we take it very seriously what machines can and should be doing. And that's probably something we haven't been doing. We've been a little bit technology deterministic, meaning, you know, we look for the features that they offer us and then we try to use them. Maybe we'll get better as consumers to say, I don't want a robot that does that. I want a robot that does this, and I don't want robots to do this and that. And so we might find ourselves being more critical consumers. I also heard recently the example of Siri, you know, the automated voice control mechanism for Apple's iOS, being helpful with children. And it did dawn on me that maybe even as adults, what we would find is that just like in our world, students can now check their grammar with Grammarly, and they can check their work, as it were. What if we had agents that checked our thinking? You know, Siri could say, on what basis are you making that claim? Or given the work you've read, why don't you extend your thinking on that? And again, this is that might be a blend where we're using our cognitive abilities in conjunction with what machines might do to assist us.
It almost sounds as if there's a very fine line between machines helping us to become better versus us becoming overly dependent on the machines. Would you see those, you know, you started out with the risk there of becoming complacent and dependent. Is it a very fine line between those two things?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in science fiction, we see that this is always a balancing act about how when we even co-evolution cedes quite a bit more power and agency to machines. And so it is a fine balance. And the question of who's in control, the question of ethics around these this balancing point is obviously something. And something I think we need to be attending to, not just in philosophy courses, but in technology courses. And I think there's been some conversation about that in the industry.
So we're accustomed to thinking of humans' relationships with robots as a kind of relationship of master and slave. So the word robot itself apparently originates from an old Slavonic word for servitude or drudgery. So we want our machines to serve us. While there's these fears of the machines rising up that are sort of popularized in science fiction like Terminator, and those fears are in a sense a fear of a kind of slave revolt, it seems to me. So either we master the technology or we risk it enslaving us. But your notion of coevolution, does that actually suggest a different kind of relationship, a relationship of partnership or collaboration between humans and machines, rather than this kind of hierarchical situation in which one or other party occupies the role of master or slave? Should we be prepared in order to thrive better in an automated future? Should we be prepared to sort of relinquish some of our control or our role as master in favor of this kind of partnership?
Whether we see to power is again something that I think we'll be deciding as we go. There's also a middle ground problem, and that is just the problem of mistakes being made. One example is high-frequency trading, which is where you have these super-fast automated processes on Wall Street trading. They got completely out of hand from humans, and even though the humans probably really didn't even intend it to be that way. So there's also an area of what we call normal accidents. So there's sort of the malicious intent version, whether it's an uprising, and then there's the slave master version, and then there's just things go wrong, you know, stuff happens. So anyway, but I think that, again, what we need to do is be more conscious of the technology. So, for example, one way to think about this is that years ago, when we were teaching when smartphones became introduced, it became a big deal to manage smartphones in a classroom. And if you think about it now, no one starts a talk by saying, "I'd like you to turn off your smartphones." I mean, effectively, we reasserted our power in saying, "Look, you know," or if it goes off, it's not the end of the world. So I think that even in simple day-to-day terms, or people going out to dinner without phones, I mean, so to some extent, we've taken a new stance to say, well, yes, they're amazing, and yes, we can hardly keep our eyes off of it, but turns out we can if we want to. If we made that even that much more conscious, we might find that we would, again, welcome the advantages and the affordance of a technology, but also quickly say, now, wait a second, how am I going to use this properly?
So that idea of coevolution resonates with certain strands of what's called post-humanist thought, but there's a more extreme version of that that's often referred to under the moniker of the transhumanist movement, which sees technology really as something that can even make us more human or even superhuman. That it's almost part of our evolutionary destiny, if you like, to try and overcome the limitations of our finite brains and our mortal bodies, using technology so that it's actually part of our evolution rather than the co-evolution. And transhumanists, while it sounds like the stuff of science fiction, there's a lot of wealthy people in Silicon Valley that are quite sort of taken with these ideas and investing in technologies designed to cheat death, designed to extend lifespan, even people working on ways in which we can think about uploading consciousness into networks and leaving the body behind. Do you have a view on that rather more sort of extreme, some would say kind of wacky perspective on how we evolve with technology?
It's not something I spend a lot of time thinking about, but I think you're right that a lot of the designers and the architects of technology do have sort of grand designs in their mind that this might be possible. And when you get some of the true visionaries in this field, I suspect they would be. It's like a moonshot. Why not go for something completely different? And again, there are sensing and intelligences that we do know are really working to take us beyond what we're able to do as humans. Coming back again to what it might do for us in a positive sense is that some neuroscientists say we have a big brain to do cognitive work. Others say that we have big brains because we can do social complex sort of things, problems. And maybe, again, what the machines do is help us take that complex problem-solving ability but extend it. So, for example, if I could read what was going on for you, more of your information, that might not be a bad thing if I really wanted to understand you. So the empathetic response might be informed by other sorts of data. And we might now attribute that to someone's charisma or their amazing ability with people. But we might say, actually, every human can do that if you have this software-enhanced take on the world. So that might be quite good. It might actually help us avoid some of the awkwardness of human encounters. So I can buy into that far. As far as the machines completely thinking for us, science fiction does lead us to think that's possible. And again, we do quickly see quite a lot of control and agency to machines. I mean, we do love our machines. We love our devices, and we start to relate to them as one of us.
So let's focus a little bit more on the human side of the equation. In your argument that the rise of robots isn't an existential threat to humanity, but an opportunity to focus on what makes humans unique and what role we will play in a highly automated future. The idea that machines can actually free us up to think and focus on the things that we're good at. And that suggests that we should clarify, I guess, what sets humans and machines apart. But it seems to me that we have a situation at the moment where we're witnessing almost a blurring or even a role reversal. So we increasingly look to our machines to take on more human-like qualities. So we want friendly AI assistants like Siri that have some kind of personality. We want our robots to become more and more human-like. There are increasingly lifelike sex robots, etc. On the other hand, that while machines are required to be more human-like, humans are increasingly required to act more like machines. So whether it's quantifying our physical activity with our Fitbits or our workplaces that increasingly require us to achieve measurable targets and quantifiable performance indicators. Do you have some sympathy with that diagnosis, that the idea that in our current moment, machines are becoming more human-like, but humans risk becoming more machine-like?
We do certainly risk that. One little example is that there is research to suggest that social platforms such as Facebook actually reduce empathy among participants or high users. So something you would think that is all good from a social point of view, like networking on a platform, actually can have unintended consequences. And losing empathy would be a tragedy for humans, because that's actually one of the things we're pretty good at, as I mentioned before. So we can be empathetic and we can display compassion to each other. And these are qualities that at the moment can be mimicked in machines for sure, but they're pretty uniquely human based at the moment. Other things we do very well and uniquely are collaboration. So we might bring our brains together to do a project, but our ability to put two ideas together, for example, which is collaborative work, which our students do all the time, and we do in lots of spheres of life, is pretty human. And then again, to learn from it is another element. So, for example, debriefing an intense activity. The Army, for example, had a major turning point years ago when they started doing what are called after-action reviews. So they really do try to experiment, have a trial or a skirmish in their case or whatever. But the point is to then sit down and say what went on, what happened there. And that's a collaborative exercise that human brains are actually able to do very well. And as far as I know, AI is not able to debrief with another computer to find a better way forward. A couple other things are context and reading context. The computer that was built in Japan that couldn't get into college quite, but it was at the 80th percentile, which is a bit frightening, was that it could not make, in a multi-choice question, it could not make a distinction of what was really going on, just the subtlety that any 10-year-old would have figured out easily. So we still have a slight advantage and able to read the subtleties of context. Again, the challenge there is looking up from screen so that we see what's going on around us, but that's a kind of another issue. And finally, I guess, meaning making and going like the college exam questions. In leadership, we find that if you think of leadership as a fairly high-end and sophisticated and important human activity, one of the things that leaders do very well is they reframe a situation. They give it new meaning or a meaning that people haven't bought into or didn't see, and from the same reality. So it's not an analytical exercise, but it's a complicated but important element of not just storytelling, but making sense of things. And again, this at the moment is something humans are pretty good, are very good at it, actually. And we need to continue and if we're going to co-evolve with machines.
Could I ask you about the field of ethics? Is ethics something which is uniquely human? Might we actually one day potentially delegate ethical decision-making to smart machines? Isn't it possible that machines, as long as we've programmed them correctly, and we would have to decide what kind of ethical calculus we wanted them to use, but isn't it possible that machines could be more consistent, less hypocritical, and better ethical decision-makers than humans?
Yeah, I totally agree. Because again, for all the things, all the qualities I just mentioned, when I teach decision making in my classes in the business school, I just try to impress upon people how bad we are at making decisions. You know, the whole field of behavioral economics basically says that we make decisions based on all sorts of irrational things. And no computer would buy a house in Auckland at Auckland prices, for example. So we get swayed, and we have other sorts of, as we know, biases and all kinds of hiring and firing decisions. And by extension, ethically, I can think of ethical situations where a program would have actually done a better job sorting out what was really the right course of action. I mean, it's possible to think of that as something that could be done. Minimally, in a co-evolutionary sense, is it could be that it's our conscience on our shoulder. So you go into a situation, if you can imagine, and you feed in the information at hand, and a computer might say, have you thought of this, or are you thinking these stakeholders? I mean, these are basically things we kind of do when we make ethical decisions. They might, actually counter to what I just said, they might reframe the decision to help us make the ethical choice that's actually more appropriate. So that actually might be an intersection where, because of the rationality that we sometimes miss or lack, that we might be better informed if we do that. Whether or not a doctor also told me that while he likes the idea of using algorithms to come up with a better diagnosis of whatever the case is, he still feels and agrees, but also is problematically, he's still the ethical decision maker for someone's final, for the care he administers. So whether we'll ever get to a point where we let the computers decide to turn the machines off or do whatever, then that becomes that would be quite a while till we get to that point, I expect.
So part of this is about an open and honest exploration of both what humans are good at, what their strengths are, but also their weaknesses, it seems. So what's the role of education in helping us to clarify and to cultivate our humanity in this world of ubiquitous, rapidly changing technology. Governments at the moment want to invest primarily in science, technology, and engineering and math subjects, so-called STEM subjects. The humanities are being squeezed. Your arguments seem to suggest that that's kind of short-sighted and that preparing for a high-tech future means more than just focusing on engineering and computational skills. Can you maybe comment on that?
Yes, I do believe that we need a counter force, and actually there was a headline or a cover story actually on one of the U.S. magazines, and the picture was of an arts graduate and saying, "Who's the new hot recruit in Silicon Valley?" So while arts isn't, it can be a lot of things, the idea of humanities, philosophy, arts being brought into the technical sphere is already happening. And we know that the consultancies have always used art students, for example. But I think that Silicon Valley is still largely run by engineers and good ones. But I think that there is a need for us as a human society in educating our youth to say, well, what else do we need to do to continue being human? And the technologies are just one part of that.
So that brings us nicely onto a topic that I want to conclude our conversation with, and that's some questions around power and control of this technology. We've been talking so far about humans as a category, but within that, who are going to be the winners and losers? Is there a risk that we might be facing even greater inequality than we have at the moment, because while the privileged among us will be collaborating or co-evolving with these exceptionally sophisticated machines, others will be locked out that won't have the access and won't have the literacies required to participate and take advantage? Is that a big risk? And what do we need to be doing, if so, in order to mitigate that risk? What kind of work do we need to be doing in the present to mitigate that kind of risk?
Yes, I kind of often get drawn to the Mad Max scenario where everyone's just sort of fending on their own, and even the gig economy starts to feel like, you know, the atomization of work and everyone's on their own. Of course, if you go to some developing cultures, maybe that's already the case. People are very entrepreneurial and very individually making their own way. But maybe it's also a Blade Runner future where there are divisions. I think the divisions are, well, we're seeing them already, and I think they're driven in part by technology, but frankly, capitalism and consumerism, I think, is creating the scenario faster than technology, or at least more than technology per se. But it does, the idea that it's a concentration of wealth and privilege, I think, is unfortunately, again, one of those scenarios we have to be very mindful of. And I think we need to keep asking, technology for what? So again, if technology bundles up privilege or bundles up and excludes people, then we have to think seriously about why are we creating technologies that do that, powerful though they may be. I'm not a philosopher, but again, I think that we have to activate that part of our thinking to ask these serious questions, because the machines won't ask those questions unless we program them to do that. and the other thing is that we've also seen what's been called winner-take-all economics. So for a while, there are a few search engines, and then there's one search engine. And for a while, there's, you know, many social platforms, and then there's a few. One scenario, too, is that it's hard to imagine that all robots and automation would come out of one factory or one conglomerate. But on the other hand, we've seen this in so many other arenas that it is also a possible scenario that, as you say, leads to a few providers being super powerful. Again, just because we've seen it, it's something we should pay attention to, even though it might be highly unlikely at this stage.
So at the moment, of course, there's a lot of controversy around the enormous power of big tech, Google, Facebook, Apple, etc. And the risk of even more sort of insidious forms of monopolistic power in the future with smart technology raises the question of really how we how we address that and how we mitigate that. And do you think there needs to be a greater role in terms of democratic and government oversight of big technology? Or is it perhaps important to move further in the direction of open source technology that is not secretive and that is open to the widest possible access and innovation and experimentation and accountability?
Yeah, well, so far governments have mostly been onlookers because they don't have the capacity necessarily to or the will to wrangle in technology. The exception, of course, being certain states like China, for example, has put walls around some of its internet. Having said that, WeChat is one of the biggest and arguably one of the best apps in the world. But again, you get into how much data are contained in one space. I don't think that many other countries will want to go down the WeChat and China approach. I think regulation, however, is starting to be an agenda, for example, not just the taxing, but the control issues. We could also see an entire generational flip on this too. We've grown up, or many of us have grown up, not being digital natives. I hear anecdotally that some of the younger generation are already less impressed by their phones and less captivated by them. We may find that there could be a generational shift that really has had enough of certain elements or wants to take charge, and by voting for it would support regulation that we can't anticipate if needed. That becomes a political will question that might surprise us in 10 years' time, depending on how things play out.
Fascinating stuff. Dahl Kolb, thank you so much.